In the arbored bedroom, the burned patient views great distances. The way that dead knight in Ravenna, whose marble body seems alive, almost liquid, has his head raised upon a stone pillow so it can gaze beyond his feet into vista, farther than a desired reign of Africa, towards all their lives in Cairo, their works and days. Hannah sits by his bed, and she travels like a squire beside him during these journeys.
In 1930 we began mapping the greater part of the Gilf Kebir Plateau, looking for the lost oasis that was called Zazura, the city of acacias. We were desert Europeans. John Bell had sighted the Gilf in 1917, then Kemal el-Din, then Bagnold, who found his way south into the Sand Sea. Maddox, Walpole of desert surveys, His Excellency Wasfi Bey, Casperius the photographer, Dr. Kedar the geologist, and Berman. And the Gilf Kebir, that large plateau resting in the Libyan desert, the size of Switzerland, as Maddox liked to say, was our heart. Its escarpments precipitous to the east and west, a plateau sloping gradually to the north. It rose out of the desert 400 miles west of the Nile. For the early Egyptians, there was supposedly no water west of the oasis towns. The world ended out there. The interior was waterless. But in the emptiness of deserts, you're always surrounded by lost history. Tebu and Senussi tribes had roamed there, possessing wells that they guarded with great secrecy. There were rumors of fertile lands that nestled within the desert's interior. Arab writers in the 13th century spoke of Zazura, the oasis of little birds, the city of acacias. In the Book of Hidden Treasures, the Kitab al-Kanuz, Zazura is depicted as a white city, white as a dove. Look at a map of the Libyan desert and you will see names. Kemal el-Din in 1925, who almost solitary carried out the first great modern expedition. Bagnold, 1930 to 1932, Al-Mashi, Maddox, 1931 to 1937, just north of the Tropic of Cancer. We were a small clutch of a nation between the wars, mapping and re-exploring. We gathered at Dakhla and Kafra as if they were bars or cafes. An oasis society, Bagnold called it. We knew each other's intimacies, each other's skills and weaknesses. We forgave Bagnold everything for the way he wrote about dunes. The grooves in the corrugated sand resembled the hollow of the roof of a dog's mouth. That was the real Bagnold, a man who had put his inquiring hand into the jaws of a dog. 1930. Our first journey, moving south from Jagbab into the desert among the preserves of the Zwaya and the Majabras tribes. A seven-day journey to El Taj, Maddox and Berman, four others. Some camels, a horse, and a dog. As we left, they told us the old joke, to start a journey in a sandstorm is good luck. We camped the first night 20 miles south. The next morning we woke and came out of our tents at 5, too cold to sleep. We stepped towards the fires and sat in their light in the larger darkness. Above us were the last stars. There would be no sunrise for another 2 hours. We passed around hot glasses of tea. The camels were being fed, half asleep, chewing the dates along with the date stones. We ate breakfast and then drank 3 more glasses of tea. Hours later we were in the sandstorm that hit us out of clear morning, coming from nowhere. The breeze that had been refreshing had gradually strengthened. Eventually we looked down and the surface of the desert was changed. Pass me that book. Here. This is Hassanein Bey's wonderful account of such storms. It is as though the surface were underlaid with steam pipes, with thousands of orifices through which tiny jets of steam are puffing out. The sand leaps in little spurts and whirls. Inch by inch the disturbance rises as the wind increases its force. It seems as though the whole surface of the desert were rising in obedience to some upthrusting force beneath. Large pebbles strike against the shins, the knees, the thighs. The sand grains climb the body till it strikes the face and goes over the head. The sky is shut out. All but the nearest objects fade from view. The universe is filled. We had to keep moving. If you pause, sand builds up as it would around anything stationary and locks you in. You are lost forever. A sandstorm can last 5 hours. Even when we were in trucks in later years, we would have to keep driving with no vision. The worst terrors came at night. Once, north of Kafra, we were hit by a storm in the darkness. 3 a.m. The gale swept the tents from their moorings, and we rolled with them, taking in sand like a sinking boat takes in water, weighed down, suffocating, till we were cut free by a camel driver. We travelled through 3 storms during 9 days. We missed small desert towns where we expected to locate more supplies. The horse vanished. 3 of the camels died. For the last 2 days there was no food, only tea. The last link with any other world was the clink of the fire-black tea urn and the long spoon and the glass which came towards us in the darkness of the mornings. After the 3rd night we gave up talking. All that mattered was the fire and the minimal brown liquid. Only by luck did we stumble on the desert town of El Taj. I walked through the souk, the alley of clocks chiming, into the street of barometers, past the rifle cartridge stalls, stands of Italian tomato sauce and other tin food from Benghazi, calico from Egypt, ostrich-tailed decorations, street dentists, book merchants. We were still mute, each of us dispersing along our own paths. We received this new world slowly, as if coming out of a drowning. In the central square of El Taj we sat and ate lamb, rice, Badawi cakes, and drank milk with almond pulp beaten into it. All this after the long wait for 3 ceremonial glasses of tea flavored with amber and mint. Sometime in 1931, I joined a Bedouin caravan and was told there was another one of us there, Fenelon Barnes, it turned out. I went to his tent. He was out for the day on some small expedition cataloguing fossil trees. I looked around his tent, the sheaf of maps, the photos he always carried of his family, etc. As I was leaving, I saw a mirror tacked up high against the skin wall, and looking at it, I saw the reflection of the bed. It seemed to be a small lump, a dog possibly, under the covers. I pulled back the jalaba, and there was a small Arab girl tied up, sleeping there. By 1932, Bagnold was finished, and Maddox and the rest of us were everywhere, looking for the lost army of Cambyses, looking for Zazura. 1932 and 1933 and 1934. Not seeing each other for months. Just the Bedouin and us crisscrossing the 40 days road. There were rivers of desert tribes, the most beautiful humans I've met in my life. We were German, English, Hungarian, African, all of us insignificant to them. Gradually we became nationless. I came to hate nations. We are deformed by nation-states. Maddox died because of nations. The desert could not be claimed or owned. It was a piece of cloth carried by winds, never held down by stones, and given 100 shifting names long before Canterbury existed, long before battles and treaties quilted Europe and the East. Its caravans, those strange, rambling feasts and cultures, left nothing behind, not an ember. All of us, even those with European homes and children in the distance, wished to remove the clothing of our countries. It was a place of faith. We disappeared into landscape, fire and sand. We left the harbors of oasis, the places water came to and touched, Ain, Bir, Wadi, Fogara, Kotara, Shaduf. I didn't want my name against such beautiful names. Erase the family name, erase nations. I was taught such things by the desert. Still, some wanted their mark there, on that dry watercourse, on this shingled knoll. Small vanities in this plot of land northwest of the Sudan, south of Cyrenaica. Fenelon Barnes wanted the fossil trees he discovered to bear his name. He even wanted a tribe to take his name and spent a year on the negotiations. And then Bokken outdid him, having a type of sand dune named after him. But I wanted to erase my name and the place I'd come from. By the time the war arrived after 10 years in the desert, it was easy for me to slip across borders, not to belong to anyone, to any nation. 1933 or 1934, I forget the year. Maddox, Gasparius, Berman, myself, two Sudanese drivers and a cook. By now, we travel in A-type Ford cars with box bodies and are using, for the first time, large balloon tires known as air wheels. They ride better on sand, but the gamble is whether they will stand up to stone fields and splinter rocks. We leave Kaga on March the 22nd. Berman and I have theorized that three wadis written about by Williamson in 1838 make up Zazura. Southwest of the Gilf Kebir are three isolated granite massifs rising out of the plain. Jabul Arkanu, Jabul Uwainat, and Jabul Kisu. The three are 15 miles apart from each other. Good water in several of the ravines, so the wells of Jabul Arkanu are bitter, not drinkable except in an emergency. Williamson said three wadis form Zazura, but he never located them, and this is considered fable. Yet even one rain oasis in these crater-shaped hills would solve the riddle of how Cambyses and his army could attempt to cross such a desert of the Senussi raids during the Great War, when the black giant raiders crossed a desert which supposedly has no water or pasture. This was a world that had been civilized for centuries, had 1,000 paths and roads. We find jars at Abu Balas with the classic Greek amphora shape. Herodotus speaks of such jars. Berman and I talk to a snake-like, mysterious old man in the fortress of El Jof, in the stone hall that once had been the library of the great Senussi sheikh, an old Tebu, a caravan guide by profession, speaking accented Arabic. Later, Berman says, like the screeching of bats, quoting Herodotus. We talk to him all day, all night, and he gives nothing away. The Senussi creed, their foremost doctrine, is still not to reveal the secrets of the desert to strangers. At Wadi El Melik, we see birds of an unknown species. On May the 5th, I climb a stone cliff and approach the Uwainat Plateau from a new direction. I find myself in a broad wadi full of acacia trees. There was a time when mapmakers named the places they traveled through with the names of lovers rather than their own. Someone seen bathing in a desert caravan, holding up Muslim with one arm in front of her. Some old Arab poet's woman, whose white dove shoulders made him describe an oasis with her name. A skin bucket spreads water over her, she wraps herself in the cloth, and the old scribe turns from her to describe Zazura. So a man in the desert can slip into a name as if within a discovered well, and in its shadowed coolness be tempted never to leave such containment. My great desire was to remain there among those acacias. I was walking not in a place where no one had walked before, but in a place where there were sudden, brief populations over the centuries, a 14th-century army, a Tebu caravan, the Senussi raiders of 1915, and in between these times, nothing was there. When no rain fell, the acacias withered, the wadis dried out, until water suddenly reappeared 50 or 100 years later, sporadic appearances and disappearances like legends and rumors through history. In the desert, the most loved waters, like a lover's name, are carried blue in your hands, enter your throat. One swallows absence. A woman in Cairo curves the white length of her body up from the bed and leans out of the window into the rainstorm to allow her nakedness to receive it.
Hannah leans forward, sensing his drifting, watching him, not saying a word. Who is she, this woman?
The ends of the earth are never the points on a map that colonists push against, enlarging their sphere of influence. On one side, servants and slaves and tides of power and correspondence with the geographical society. On the other, the first step by a white man across a great river. The first sight by a white eye of a mountain that has been there forever. When we are young, we do not look into mirrors. It is when we are old, concerned with our name, our legend, what our lives will mean to the future. We become vain with the names we own, Our claims to have been the first eyes, the strongest army, the cleverest merchant. It is when he is old that Narcissus wants a graven image of himself. But we were interested in how our lives could mean something to the past. We sailed into the past. We were young. We knew power and great finance were temporary things. We all slept with Herodotus. For those cities that were great in earlier times must have now become small, and those that were great in my time were small in the time before. Man's good fortune never abides in the same place. In 1936, a young man named Geoffrey Clifton had met a friend at Oxford who mentioned what we were doing. He contacted me, got married the next day, and 2 weeks later flew with his wife to Cairo. The couple entered our world. The four of us, Prince Kamal el-Din, Bel, Al-Mashi, and Maddox, the name that still filled our mouths with Gilf Kebir. Somewhere in the Gilf nestled Zazura, whose name occurs in Arab writings as far back as the 13th century. When you travel that far in time, you need a plane, and young Clifton was rich, and he could fly, and he had a plane. Clifton met us in El Jof, north of Uinat. He sat in his two-seater plane, and we walked towards him from the base camp. He stood up in the cockpit and poured a drink out of his flask. His new wife sat beside him. "I name this site Bir Messaha Country Club," he announced. I watched the friendly uncertainties scattered across his wife's face, her lion-like hair when she pulled off her leather helmet. They were youth, felt like our children. They climbed out of the plane and shook hands with us. That was 1936, the beginning of our story. They jumped off the wing of the moth. Clifton walked towards us, holding out the flask, and we all sipped the warm alcohol. He was one for ceremonies. He had named his plane Rupert Bear. I don't think he loved the desert, but he had an affection for it that grew out of awe at our stark order, into which he wanted to fit himself, like a joyous undergraduate who respects silent behavior in a library. We had not expected him to bring his wife, but we were, I suppose, courteous about it. She stood there while the sand collected in her mane of hair. What were we to this young couple? Some of us had written books about dune formation, the disappearance and reappearance of oases, the lost culture of deserts. We seemed to be interested only in things that could not be bought or sold, of no interest to the outside world. We argued about latitudes, nor about an event that had happened 700 years earlier, the theorems of exploration, that Abdel Melek Ibrahim El-Zweya, who lived in Zouk Oasis pasturing camels, was the first man among those tribes who could understand the concept of photographs. The Cliftons were on the last days of their honeymoon. I left them with the others and went to join a man in Kafra and spent many days with him trying out theories I'd kept secret from the rest of the expedition. I returned to the base camp at El Jof 3 nights later. The desert fire was between us. The Cliftons, Maddox, Bell, and myself. If a man leaned back a few inches, he would disappear into darkness. Catherine Clifton began to recite something, and my head was no longer in the halo of the camp's twig fire. There was a classical blood in her face. Her parents were famous, apparently, in the world of legal history. I am a man who did not enjoy poetry until I heard a woman recite it to us. And in that desert she dragged her university days into our midst to describe the stars, the way Adam tenderly taught a woman with gracious metaphors. "These, then, though unbeheld in deep of night, shine not in vain, nor think, though men were none, that heaven would want spectators, God want praise. Millions of spiritual creatures walk the earth unseen, both when we wake and when we sleep. All these with ceaseless praise his works behold, both day and night. How often from the steep of echoing hill or thicket have we heard celestial voices to the midnight air, soul or responsive each to other's note, singing their great creator." That night I fell in love with a voice, only a voice. I wanted to hear nothing more. I got up and walked away. She was a willow, What would she be like in winter at my age? I see her still always with the eye of Adam. She had been these awkward limbs climbing out of a plane, bending down in our midst to prod at a fire, her elbow up and pointed towards me as she drank from her canteen. A few months later, she waltzed with me as we danced as a group in Cairo. Though slightly drunk, she wore an unconquerable face. Even now, the face I believe that most revealed her was the one she had that time when we were both half-drunk, not lovers. All these years I've been trying to unearth what she was handing me with that look. It seemed to be contempt, so it appeared to me. Now I think she was studying me. She was an innocent, surprised at something in me. I was behaving the way I usually behave in bars, but this time with the wrong company. I'm a man who kept the codes of my behavior separate. I was forgetting she was younger than I. She was studying me. Such a simple thing. And I was watching for one wrong move in her statue-like gaze, something that would give her away. Give me a map and I'll build you a city. Give me a pencil and I will draw you a room in South Cairo. Desert charts on the wall. Always the desert was among us. I could wake and raise my eyes to the map of old settlements along the Mediterranean coast. Gazala, Tobruk, Mersa Matru. And south of that, the hand-painted wadis. And surrounding those, the shades of yellowness that we invaded, tried to lose ourselves in. My task is to describe briefly the several expeditions which have attacked the Gilf Kebir. Dr. Berman will later take us back to the desert as it existed thousands of years ago. That is the way Madoff spoke to other geographers at Kensington Gore. But you do not find adultery in the minutes of the Geographical Society. Our room never appears in the detailed reports which charted every knoll and every incident of history. In the street of imported parrots in Cairo, one is hectored by almost articulate birds. The birds bark and whistle in rows like a plumed avenue. I knew which tribe had travelled, which silk or camel road carrying them in their petite palanquins across the deserts. 40-day journeys, after the birds were caught by slaves or picked like flowers in equatorial gardens and then placed in bamboo cages to enter the river that is trade. They appeared like brides in a medieval courtship. We stood among them. I was showing her a city that was new to her. Her hand touched me at the wrist. If I gave you my life, you would drop it, wouldn't you? I didn't say anything.
Part 5. Catherine. The first time she dreamed of him, she woke up beside her husband screaming. In their bedroom she stared down onto the sheet, mouth open. Her husband put his hand on her back. Nightmare, don't worry.
Yes.
Shall I get you some water?
Yes.
She wouldn't move, wouldn't lie back into that zone they had been in. The dream had taken place in this room, his hand on her neck. She touched it now. His anger towards her that she had sensed the first few times she had met him. No, not anger. A lack of interest. Irritation at a married woman being among them. They had been bent over like animals, and he had yoked her neck back so she had been unable to breathe within her arousal. Her husband brought her the glass on a saucer, but she could not lift her arms. They were shaking, loose. He put the glass awkwardly against her mouth so she could gulp the chlorinated water, some coming down her chin, falling to her stomach. When she lay back, she hardly had time to think of what she had witnessed. She fell into a quick, deep sleep. That had been the first recognition. She remembered it sometime during the next day, but she was busy then, and she refused to nestle with its significance for long, dismissed it. It was an accidental collision on a crowded night, nothing more. A year later, the other, more dangerous, peaceful dreams came. And even within the first one of these she recalled the hands at her neck and waited for the mood of calmness between them to swerve to violence. Who lays the crumbs of food that tempt you? To towards a person you never considered, a dream, then later another series of dreams. He said later it was propinquity, propinquity in the desert. It does that here, he said. He loved the word, the propinquity of water, the propinquity of two or three bodies in a car driving the sand sea for 6 hours, her sweating knee beside the gearbox of the truck, the knee swerving, rising with the bumps. In the desert you have time to look everywhere, to theorize on the choreography of all things around you. When he talked like that, she hated him, her eyes remaining polite, her mind wanting to slap him. She always had the desire to slap him, and she realized even that was sexual. For him, all relationships fell into patterns. You fell into propinquity or distance. Just as, for him, the histories in Herodotus clarified all societies. He assumed he was experienced in the ways of the world he had essentially left years earlier, struggling ever since to explore a half-invented world of the desert. At Cairo Aerodrome, they loaded the equipment into the vehicles, her husband staying on to check the petrol lines of the Moth, before the three men left the next morning. Maddox went off to one of the embassies to send a wire, and he was going into town to get drunk. The usual final evening in Cairo, first at Madame Baden's opera casino, and later to disappear into the streets behind the Pasha Hotel. He would pack before the evening began, which would allow him to just climb into the truck the next morning, hungover. So he drove her into town, the air humid, the traffic bad and slow because of the hour. "Oh, so hot. I need a beer. Do you want one?" "No, I have to arrange for a lot of things in the next couple of hours. You'll have to excuse me." "Oh, that's all right," she said. I don't want to interfere." "I'll have one with you when I come back." "In 3 weeks?" "Right." "About that." "I wish I were going too." He said nothing in answer to that. They crossed the Bulak Bridge and the traffic got worse. Too many carts, too many pedestrians who owned the streets. He cut south along the Nile towards the Semiramis Hotel, where she was staying, just beyond the barracks. "You're going to find Zazira this time, aren't you?"
"I'm going to find it this time."
He was like his old self. He hardly looked at her on the drive, even when they were stalled for more than 5 minutes in one spot. At the hotel he was excessively polite. When he behaved this way, she liked him even less. They all had to pretend this pose was courtesy, graciousness. It reminded her of a dog in clothes. To hell with him. If her husband didn't have to work with him, she'd prefer not to see him again. He pulled her pack out of the rear and was about to carry it into the lobby. "Here, I can take that." Her shirt was damp at the back when she got out of the passenger seat. The doorman offered to take the pack, but he said, "No, she wants to carry it." And she was angry again at his assumption. The doorman left them. She turned to him, and he passed her the bag so she was facing him, both hands awkwardly carrying the heavy case in front of her. "So, goodbye. Good luck."
"Yes, I'll look after them all. They'll be safe."
She nodded. She was in shadow, and he, as if unaware of the harsh sunlight, stood in it. Then he came up to her, closer, and she thought for a moment he was going to embrace her. Instead, he put his right arm forward and drew it in a gesture across her bare neck, so her skin was touched by the whole length of his damp forearm. "Goodbye." He walked back to the truck. She could feel his sweat now, like blood left by a blade which the gesture of his arm seemed to have imitated. She picks up a cushion and places it onto her lap as a shield against him. "If you make love to me, I won't lie about it. If I make love to you, I won't lie about it." She moves the cushion against her heart, as if she would suffocate that part of herself which has broken free. "What do you hate most?" he asks.
"A lie. And you?"
"Ownership," he says. "When you leave me, forget me." Her fist swings towards him and hits hard into the bone just below his eye. She dresses and leaves. Each day he would return home and look at the black bruise in the mirror. He became curious, not so much about the bruise, but about the shape of his face. The long eyebrows he had never really noticed before, the beginning of grey in his sandy hair. He had not looked at himself like this in a mirror for years. That was a long eyebrow. Nothing can keep him from her. When he is not in the desert with Maddox or with Berman in the Arab libraries, he meets her in Groppy Park, beside the heavily watered plum gardens. She is happiest here. She is a woman who misses moisture, who has always loved low green hedges and ferns, while for him this much greenery feels like a carnival. From Groppy Park they arc out into the old city, South Cairo, markets where few Europeans go. In his rooms, maps cover the walls, and in spite of his attempts at furnishing, there is still a sense of base camp to his quarters. They lie in each other's arms, the pulse and shadow of the fan on them. All morning he and Berman have worked in the archaeological museum, placing Arabic texts and European histories beside each other in an attempt to recognize echo, coincidence, name changes. Back past Herodotus, to the Kitab al-Kanuz, where Zazura is named after the bathing woman in a desert caravan. And there, too, the slow blink of a fan shadow. And here, too, the intimate exchange and echo of childhood history, of scar, of manner of kiss. I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. How can I be your lover? He will go mad. A list of wounds. The various colors of the bruise, bright russet leading to brown. The plate she walked across the room with, flinging its contents aside, and broke across his head, the blood rising up into the straw hair. The fork that entered the back of his shoulder, leaving its bite marks the doctor suspected were caused by a fox. He would step into an embrace with her, glancing first to see what movable objects were around. He would meet her with others in public with bruises or a bandaged head, and explain about the taxi jerking to a halt so that he had hit the open side window, or with iodine on his forearm that covered a welt. Maddox worried about his becoming suddenly accident-prone. She sneered quietly at the weakness of his explanation. "Maybe it's his age. Maybe he needs glasses," said her husband, nudging Maddox. "Maybe it's a woman he met," she said. "Look, isn't that a woman's scratch or bite?" "It was a scorpion," he said. "Androctonus australis." A postcard, neat handwriting, fills the rectangle. "Half my days I cannot bear not to touch you. The rest of the time I feel it doesn't matter if I ever see you again. It isn't the morality, it's how much you can bear." No date, no name attached. Sometimes, when she is able to spend the night with him, they are wakened by the three minarets of the city beginning their prayers before dawn. He walks with her through the indigo markets that lie between South Cairo and her home. The beautiful songs of faith enter the air like arrows, one minaret answering another as if passing on a rumour of the two of them as they walk through the cold morning air, the smell of charcoal and hemp already making the air profound. Sinners in a holy city. He sweeps his arm across plates and glasses on a restaurant table, so she might look up somewhere else in the city, hearing this cause of noise. When he is without her. He, who has never felt alone in the miles of longitude between desert towns. A man in a desert can hold absence in his cupped hands, knowing it is something that feeds him more than water. There is a plant he knows of near El Taj, whose heart, if one cuts it out, is replaced with a fluid containing herbal goodness. Every morning one can drink the liquid, the amount of a missing heart. The plant continues to flourish for a year before it dies from some lack or other. He lies in his room, surrounded by the pale maps. He is without Catherine. His hunger wishes to burn down all social rules, all courtesy. Her life with others no longer interests him. He wants only her stalking beauty, her theatre of expressions. He wants the minute and secret reflection between them, the depth of field minimal, their foreignness intimate like two pages of a closed book. He has been disassembled by her. And if she has brought him to this, what has he brought her to? When she is within the wall of her class, and he is beside her in larger groups, he tells jokes he doesn't laugh at himself. Uncharacteristically manic, he attacks the history of exploration.
When he is unhappy, he does this. Only Maddox recognizes the habit, but she will not even catch his eye. She smiles to everyone, to the objects in the room, praises a flower arrangement, worthless, impersonal things. She misinterprets his behavior, assuming this is what he wants, and doubles the size of the wall to protect herself. But now he cannot bear this wall in her. "You built your walls too," she tells him, "so I have my wall." She says it glittering in a beauty he cannot stand. She, with her beautiful clothes, with her pale face that laughs at everyone who smiles at her, with the uncertain grin for his angry jokes. He continues his appalling statements about this and that in some expedition they are all familiar with. The minute she turns away from him in the lobby of Groppi's bar, after he greets her, he is insane. He knows the only way he can accept losing her is if he can continue to hold her or be held by her. If they can somehow nurse each other out of this, not with a wall. Sunlight pours into his Cairo room, his hand flabby over the Herodotus journal, all the tension in the rest of his body. So he writes words down wrong, the pen sprawling as if without spine. He can hardly write down the word sunlight, the words in love. In the apartment there is light only from the river and the desert beyond it. It falls upon her neck, her feet, the vaccination scar he loves on her right arm. She sits on the bed, hugging nakedness. He slides his open palm along the sweat of her shoulder. "This is my shoulder," he thinks, "not her husband's. This is my shoulder." As lovers, they have offered parts of their bodies to each other, like this, in this room on the periphery of the river. In the few hours they have, the room has darkened to this pitch of light, just river and desert light. Only when there is the rare shock of rain do they go towards the window and put their arms out, stretching, to bathe as much as they can of themselves in it. Shouts towards the brief downpour fill the streets. "We will never love each other again. We can never see each other again." "I know," he says, the night of her insistence on parting. She sits, enclosed within herself, in the armor of her terrible conscience. He is unable to reach through it. Only his body is close to her. "Never again, whatever happens." "Yes, I think he will go mad. Do you understand?" He says nothing, abandoning the attempt to pull her within him. An hour later they walk into the dry night. They can hear the gramophone songs in the distance from the Music for All cinema, its windows open for the heat. They will have to part before that closes up and people she might know emerge from there. They are in the botanical garden near the Cathedral of All Saints. She sees one tear and leans forward and licks it, taking it into her mouth, as she has taken the blood from his hand when he cut himself cooking for her. Blood, tear. He feels everything is missing from his body, feels he contains smoke. All that is alive is the knowledge of future desire and want. What he would say, he cannot say to this woman whose openness is like a wound, whose youth is not mortal yet. He cannot alter what he loves most in her, her lack of compromise, where the romance of the poems she loves still sits with ease in the real world. Outside these qualities, he knows there is no order in the world. This night of her insistence, 28th of September. The rain in the trees already dried by hot moonlight. Not one cool drop to fall down upon him like a tear. This parting at Groppi Park. He has not asked if her husband is home in that high square of light across the street. He sees the tall row of travellers' palms above them, their outstretched wrists. The way her head and hair were above him when she was his lover. Now there is no kiss, just one embrace. He untugs himself from her and walks away, then turns. She's still there. He comes back within a few yards of her, one finger raised to make a point. "I just want you to know, I don't miss you yet." His face awful to her, trying to smile. Her head sweeps away from him and hits the side of the gatepost. He sees it hurt her, notices the wince. But they have separated already into themselves now, the walls up at her insistence. Her jerk, her pain, is accidental, is intentional. Her hand is near her temple. You will, she says.
From this point on in our lives,
she had whispered to him earlier,
we will either find or lose our souls. How does this happen? To fall in love and be dissembled. I was in her arms. I had pushed the sleeve of her shirt up to the shoulder so I could see her vaccination scar. I love this, I said. This pale aureole on her arm. I see the instrument scratch and then punch the serum within her and then release itself, free of her skin. Years ago, when she was 9 years old in a school gymnasium.
Part 6. A Buried Plane. He glares out, each eye a path, down the long bed at the end of which is Hannah. After she has bathed him, she breaks the tip off an ampoule and turns to him with a morphine. An effigy. A bed. He rides the boat of morphine. It races in him, imploding time and geography, the way maps compress the world onto a two-dimensional sheet of paper.
The long Cairo evenings, the sea of night sky, hawks in rows until they are released at dusk, arcing towards the last color of the desert. A unison of performance like a handful of thrown seed. In that city in 1936 you could buy anything, from a dog or a bird that came at one pitch of a whistle, to those terrible leashes that slipped over the smallest finger of a woman so she was tethered to you in a crowded market. In the northeast section of Cairo was the great courtyard of religious students, and beyond it the Khan el-Khalili Bazaar. Above the narrow streets we looked down upon cats on the corrugated tin roofs, who also looked down the next 10 feet to the street and stalls. Above all this was our room. Windows open to minarets, feluccas, cats, tremendous noise. She spoke to me of her childhood gardens. When she couldn't sleep, she drew her mother's garden for me word by word, bed by bed. The December ice over the fish pond, the creak of rose trellises. She would take my wrist at the confluence of veins and guide it into the hollow indentation at her neck. March 1937, Uinat. Maddox is irritable because of the thinness in the air. 1,500 feet above sea level, and he's uncomfortable with even this minimal height. He is a desert man, after all, having left his family village of Marston Magnus, Somerset, alter all customs and habits so he can have the proximity to sea level as well as regular dryness. Maddox, what is the name of that hollow at the base of a woman's neck, at the front, here? What is it? Does it have an official name? That hollow about the size of an impress of your thumb? Maddox watches me for a moment through the noon glare. Pull yourself together, he mutters.
Let me tell you a story, Caravaggio says to Hannah. There was a Hungarian named Almasy who worked for the Germans during the war. He flew a bit with the Africa Corps, but he was more valuable than that. In the 1930s, he'd been one of the great desert explorers. He knew every waterhole and had helped map the Sand Sea. He knew all about the desert. He knew all about dialects. Does this sound familiar? Between the two wars, he was always on expeditions out of Cairo. One was to search for Zizura, the last oasis. Then, when war broke out, he joined the Germans. In 1941, he became a guide for spies, taking them across the desert into Cairo. What I want to tell you is, I think the English patient is not English. Of course he is. What about all those flower beds in Gloucestershire? Precisely. It's all a perfect background. 2 nights ago, when we were trying to name the dog, remember? Yes. What were his suggestions? Well, he was strange that night. He was very strange because I gave him an extra dose of morphine. Do you remember the names? He put out about 8 names. 5 of them were obvious jokes. Then 3 names. Cicero, Caesura, Delilah. So? Cicero was a code name for a spy. The British unearthed him. A double, then triple agent. He got away.
Zazura is more complicated. I know about Zazura. He's talked about it. He also talks about gardens. But it is mostly the desert now. The English garden is wearing thin. He's dying. I think you have the spy helper Almashi upstairs.
They sit on the old cane hampers of the linen room, looking at each other.
Caravaggio shrugs. It's possible.
I think he is an Englishman, she says, sucking in her cheeks as she always does when she is thinking or considering something about herself.
I know you love the man, but he's not an Englishman. In the early part of the war, I was working in Cairo, the Tripoli Axis, Rommel's Rebecca spy.
What do you mean, Rebecca spy?
In 1942, the Germans sent a spy called Eppler into Cairo before the Battle of El Alamein. He used a copy of Daphne du Maurier's novel Rebecca as a code book to send messages back to Rommel on troop movements. Listen, the book became bedside reading with British intelligence. Even I read it.
You read a book?
Thank you. The man who guided Eppler through the desert into Cairo on Rommel's personal orders, from Tripoli all the way to Cairo, was Count Ladislaw de Almashi. This was a stretch of desert that, it was assumed, no one could cross. Between the wars, Almashi had English friends, great explorers. But when the war broke out, he went with the Germans. Rommel asked him to take Eppler across the desert into Cairo because it would have been too obvious by plane or parachute. He crossed the desert with the guy and delivered him to the Nile Delta.
You know a lot about this.
I was based in Cairo. We were tracking them. From Giallo, he led a company of 8 men into the desert. They had to keep digging the trucks out of the sandhills. He aimed them towards Ouinat and its granite plateau so that they could get water, take shelter in the caves. It was a halfway point. In the 1930s, he had discovered caves with rock paintings there. But the plateau was crawling with allies, and he couldn't use the wells there. He struck out into the sand desert again. They raided British petrol dumps to fill up their tanks. In the Kaga Oasis, they switched into British uniforms and hung British Army number plates on their vehicles. When they were spotted from the air, they hid in the wadis for as long as 3 days, completely still, baking to death in the sand. It took them 3 weeks to reach Cairo. Almashi shook hands with Eppler and left him. This is where we lost him. He turned and went back into the desert alone. We think he crossed it again, back towards Tripoli, but that was the last time he was ever seen. The British picked up Eppler eventually and used the Rebecca code to feed false information to Rommel about El Alamein.
I still don't believe it, David.
The man who helped catch Eppler in Cairo was named Sansom.
Delilah.
Exactly.
Maybe he's Sansom.
I thought of that at first. He was very like Almashi, a desert lover as well. He had spent his childhood in the Levant and knew the Bedouin. But the thing about Almashi was he could fly. We are talking about someone who crashed in a plane. Here is this man, burned beyond recognition, who somehow ends up in the arms of the English at Pisa. Also, he can get away with sounding English. Almashi went to school in England. In Cairo, he was referred to as the English spy.
She sat on the hamper watching Caravaggio. She said, I think we should leave him be. It doesn't matter what side he was on, does it?
Caravaggio said, I'd like to talk with him some more, with more morphine in him. Talking it out, both of us. Do you understand? Do you see where it will all go? Delilah, Zazura. You will have to give him the altered shot.
No, David, you're too obsessed. It doesn't matter who he is. The war's over.
I will, then. I'll cook up a Brompton cocktail, morphine and alcohol. They invented it at Brompton Hospital in London for their cancer patients. Don't worry, it won't kill him. It absorbs fast into the body. I can put it together with what we've got. Give him a drink of it, then put him back on straight morphine.
She watched him sitting on the hamper, clear-eyed, smiling. During the last stages of the war, Caravaggio had become one of the numerous morphia thieves. He had sniffed out her medical supplies within hours of his arrival. The small tubes of morphine were now a source for him, like toothpaste tubes for dolls,
she had thought when she first saw them, finding them utterly quaint. Caravaggio carried 2 or 3 in his pocket all day long, slipping the fluid into his flesh. She had stumbled on him once, vomiting from its excess, crouched and shaking in one of the dark corners of the villa, looking up and hardly recognizing her. She had tried speaking with him, and he had stared back. He had found the metal supply box, torn it open with God knows what strength. Once, when the sapper cut open the palm of his hand on an iron gate, Caravaggio broke the glass tip off with his teeth, sucked and spat the morphine onto the brown hand before Kip even knew what it was. Kip pushing him away, glaring in anger. "Leave him alone. He's my patient.
I won't damage him. The morphine and alcohol will take away the pain."
3cc's Brompton Cocktail, 3 p.m. Caravaggio slips the book out of the man's hands.
"When you crashed in the desert, where were you flying from?"
"I was leaving the Gulf Kebir. I had gone there to collect someone in late August, 1942.
"During the war? Everyone must have left by then."
"Yes. There were just armies."
"The Gulf Kebir?"
"Yes."
"Where is it?"
"Give me the Kipling book. Here."
On the frontispiece of Kim was a map with a dotted line for the path the boy and the Holy One took. It showed just a portion of India, a darkly cross-hatched Afghanistan, and Kashmir in the lap of the mountains. He traces his black hand along the Numi River till it enters the sea at 23°30' latitude. He continues sliding his figure 7 inches west, off the page, onto his chest. He touches his rib.
"Here, the Gulf Kebir, just north of the Tropic of Cancer, on the Egyptian-Libyan border."
"What happened in 1942?
I had made the journey to Cairo and was returning from there. I was slipping between the enemy, remembering old maps, hitting the pre-war caches of petrol and water, driving towards Ouenat. It was easier now that I was alone. Miles from the Gulf Kebir, the truck exploded and I capsized, rolling automatically into the sand, not wanting a spark to touch me. In the desert, one is always frightened of fire. The truck exploded, probably sabotaged. There were spies among the Bedouin, whose caravans continued to drift like cities, carrying spice, rums, government advisers, wherever they went. At any given moment among the Bedouin in those days of the war, there were Englishmen as well as Germans. Leaving the truck, I started walking towards Ouenat, where I knew there was a buried plane."
"Oh, wait. What do you mean, a buried plane?"
"Maddox had an old plane in the early days, which he had shaved down to the essentials. The only extra was the closed bubble of cockpit, crucial for desert flights. During our times in the desert, he had taught me to fly, the two of us walking around the guy-roped creature, theorizing on how it hung or veered in the wind. When Clifton's plane, Rupert, flew into our midst, the aging plane of Maddox's was left where it was, covered with a tarpaulin, pegged down in one of the northeast alcoves of Ouenat. Sand collected over it gradually for the next few years. None of us thought we would see it again. It was another victim of the desert. Within a few months we would pass the northeast gully and see no contour of it. By now Clifton's plane, 10 years younger, had flown into our story."
"So you were walking towards it?"
"Yes. 4 nights of walking. I'd left the man in Cairo and turned back into the desert. Everywhere there was war. Suddenly there were teams, the Burmans, the Bagnols, the Slatin Pashas, who had at various times saved each other's lives, had now split up into camps. I walked towards Ouenat. I got there about noon and climbed up into the caves of the plateau, above the well named Ain Dua."
"Caravaggio thinks he knows who you are," Hannah said. The man in the bed said nothing. "He says you're not English. He worked with intelligence out of Cairo and Italy for a while, till he was captured. My family knew Caravaggio before the war. He was a thief. He believed in the movement of things.
Some thieves are collectors, like some of the explorers you scorn, like some men with women or some women with men. But Caravaggio was not like that. He was too curious and generous to be a successful thief. Half the things he stole never came home. He thinks you are not English. She watched his stillness as she spoke. It appeared that he was not listening carefully to what she was saying, just his distant thinking. The way Duke Ellington looked and thought when he played Solitude. She stopped talking. He reached the shallow well named Ain Dua. He removed all of his clothes and soaked them in the well, put his head and then his thin body into the blue water, his limbs exhausted from the 4 nights of walking. He left his clothes spread on the rocks and climbed up higher into the boulders, climbed out of the desert, which was now, in 1942, a vast battlefield, and went naked into the darkness of the cave. He was among the familiar paintings he had found years earlier, giraffes, cattle, the man with his arms raised in a plumed headdress, several figures in the unmistakable posture of swimmers. Berman had been right about the presence of an ancient lake. He walked farther into the coldness, into the cave of swimmers, where he had left her. She was still there. She had dragged herself into a corner, had wrapped herself tight in the parachute material. He had promised to return for her. He himself would have been happier to die in a cave with its privacy, the swimmers caught in the rock around them. Berman had told him that in Asian gardens you could look at rock and imagine water, you could gaze at a still pool and believe it had the hardness of rock. But she was a woman who had grown up within gardens, among moistness, with words like trellis and hedgehog. Her passion for the desert was temporary. She'd come to love its sternness because of him, wanting to understand his comfort in its solitude. She was always happier in rain, in bathroom steaming with liquid air, in sleepy wetness, climbing back in from his window that rainy night in Cairo, and putting on her clothes while still wet, in order to hold it all. Just as she loved family traditions and courteous ceremony and old memorized poems. She would have hated to die without a name. For her there was a line back to her ancestors that was tactile, whereas he had erased the path he had emerged from. He was amazed she had loved him in spite of such qualities of anonymity in himself. She was on her back, positioned the way the medieval dead lie.
I approached her naked, as I would have done in our South Cairo room, wanting to undress her, still wanting to love her. What is terrible in what I did? Don't we forgive everything of a lover? We forgive selfishness, desire, guile, as long as we are the motive for it. You can make love to a woman with a broken arm or a woman with fever. She once sucked blood from a cut on my hand as I had tasted and swallowed her menstrual blood. There are some European words you can never translate properly into another language. Fell homily, the dusk of graves, with a connotation of intimacy there between the dead and the living. I lifted her into my arms from the shelf of sleep. Clothing like cobweb, I disturbed all that. I carried her out into the sun. I dressed, my clothes dry and brittle from the heat in the stones. My linked hands made a saddle for her to rest on. As soon as I reached the sand, I jostled her around so her body was facing back over my shoulder. I was conscious of the airiness of her weight. I was used to her like this in my arms. She had spun around me in my room like a human reflection of the fan, her arms out, fingers like starfish. We moved like this towards the northeast gully, where the plane was buried. I did not need a map. With me was the tank of petrol I had carried all the way from the capsized truck, because 3 years earlier we'd been impotent without it.
What happened 3 years earlier?
She had been injured. In 1939, her husband had crashed his plane. It had been planned as a suicide murder by her husband that would involve all three of us. We were not even lovers at the time. I suppose information of the affair trickled down to him somehow.
So she was too wounded to take with you?
Yes. The only chance to save her was for me to try and reach help alone.
In the cave, after all those months of separation and anger, they had come together and spoken once more as lovers, rolling away the boulder they had placed between themselves for some social law neither had believed in. In the botanical garden she had banged her head against the gatepost in determination and fury, too proud to be a lover, a secret. There would be no compartments in her world. He had turned back to her, his finger raised. "I don't miss you yet. You will." During their months of separation he had grown bitter and self-sufficient. He avoided her company. He could not stand her calmness when she saw him. He phoned her house and spoke to her husband, and heard her laughter in the background. There was a public charm in her that tempted everyone. This was something he had loved in her. Now he began to trust nothing. He suspected she had replaced him with another lover. He interpreted her every gesture to others as a code of promise. She gripped the front of Roundel's jacket once in a lobby and shook it, laughing at him as he muttered something, and he followed the innocent government aide for 2 days to see if there was more between them. He did not trust her last endearments to him any more. She was with him or against him. She was against him. He couldn't stand even her tentative smiles at him. If she passed him a drink, he would not drink it. If, at a dinner, she pointed to a bowl with a Nile lily floating in it, he would not look at it. Just another fucking flower. She had a new group of intimates that excluded him and her husband. No one goes back to the husband. He knew that much about love and human nature. He bought pale brown cigarette papers and glued them into sections of the histories that recorded wars that were of no interest to him. He wrote down all her arguments against him, glued into the book, giving himself only the voice of the watcher, the listener, the he. During the last days before the war, he had gone for a last time to the Gilf Kebir to clear out the base camp. Her husband was supposed to pick him up, the husband they had both loved until they began to love each other. Clifton flew up on Uinat to collect him on the appointed day, buzzing the lost oasis so low the acacia shrubs dismantled their leaves in the wake of the plane, the moths slipping into the depressions and cuts, while he stood on the high ridge signalling with blue tarpaulin. Then the plane pivoted down and came straight towards him, then crashed into the earth 50 yards away, a blue line of smoke uncoiling from the undercarriage. There was no fire. Her husband gone mad, killing all of them, killing himself and his wife, and him by the fact that there was now no way out of the desert. Only she was not dead. He pulled the body free, carrying it out of the plane's crumpled grip, this grip of her husband. "How did you hate me?" she whispers in the cave of swimmers, talking through her pain of injuries, a broken wrist, shattered ribs. "You were terrible to me. That's when my husband suspected you. I still hate that about you, disappearing into deserts or bars. You left me in Croppy Park because you didn't want me as anything else. Because you said your husband was going mad. Well, he went mad." "Not for a long time. I went mad before he did. You killed everything in me. Kiss me, will you? Stop defending yourself. Kiss me and call me by my name." Their bodies had met in perfumes, in sweat, frantic to get under that thin film with a tongue or a tooth, as if they each could grip character there and, during love, pull it right off the body of the other. Now there is no talcum on her arm, no rosewater on her thigh. "You think you're an iconoclast, but you're not. You just move or replace what you cannot have. If you fail at something, you retreat into something else. Nothing changes you. How many women did you have? I left you because I knew I could never change you. You would stand in the room so still sometimes, so wordless sometimes, as if the greatest betrayal of yourself would be to reveal one more inch of your character." "In the cave of swimmers we talked. We were only 2 latitudes away from the safety of Gufra." He pauses and holds out his hand. Caravaggio places a morphine tablet into the black palm, and it disappears into the man's dark mouth.
"I crossed the dry bed of the lake towards Kufra Oasis, carrying nothing but robes against the heat and night cold, my Herodotus left behind with her. And 3 years later, in 1942, I walked with her towards the buried plain, carrying her body as if it were the armor of a knight. In the desert, the tools of survival are underground. Troglodyte caves, water sleeping within a buried plant, weapons, a plane. At longitude 25, latitude 23, I dug down towards the tarpaulin, and Maddox's old plane gradually emerged. It was night, and even in the cold air I was sweating. I carried the naphtha lantern over to her and sat for a while beside the silhouette of her nod. Two lovers and desert, starlight or moonlight, I don't remember. Everything else out there was a war. The plane came out of the sand. There had been no food, and I was weak. The tarp so heavy I couldn't dig it out, but had simply to cut it away. In the morning, after 2 hours' sleep, I carried her into the cockpit. I started the motor, and it rolled into life. We moved, and then slipped, years too late, into the sky.
The voice stops. The burned man looks straight ahead in his morphine focus. The plane is now in his eye. The slow voice carries it with effort above the earth, the engine missing turns as if losing a stitch, her shroud unfurling in the noisy air of the cockpit, noise terrible after his days of walking in silence. He looks down and sees oil pouring onto his knees. A branch breaks free of her shirt, acacia and bone. How high is he above the land? How low is he in the sky? The undercarriage brushes the top of a palm, and he pivots up, and the oil slides over the seat, her body slipping down into it. There is a spark from a short, and the twigs at her knee catch fire. He pulls her back into the seat beside him. He thrusts his hand up against the cockpit glass, and it will not shift. Begins punching the glass, cracking it, finally breaking it, and the oil and the fire slop and spin everywhere. How low is he in the sky? She collapses. Acacia twigs, leaves, the branches that were shaped into arms uncoiling around him. Limbs begin disappearing in the suck of air. The odor of morphine on his tongue. Caravaggio reflected in the black lake of his eye. He goes up and down now like a well bucket. There is blood somehow all over his face. He is flying a rotted plane, the canvas sheetings on the wings ripping open in the speed. They are carrion. How far back had the palm tree been? How long ago? He lifts his legs out of the oil, but they are so heavy. There is no way he can lift them again. He is old, suddenly, tired of living without her. He cannot lie back in her arms and trust her to stand guard all day, all night while he sleeps. He has no one. He is exhausted, not from the desert, but from solitude. Maddox gone. The woman translated into leaves and twigs, the broken glass to the sky like a jaw above him. He slips into the harness of the oil-wet parachute and pivots upside down, breaking free of glass, wind flinging his body back. Then his legs are free of everything, and he is in the air, bright, not knowing why he is bright until he realizes he is on fire. Hannah can hear the voices in the English patient's room, and stands in the hall trying to catch what they are saying. How is it?
Wonderful.
Now it's my turn.
Ah, splendid, splendid.
This is the greatest of inventions.
A remarkable find, young man.
When she enters, she sees Kip and the English patient passing a can of condensed milk back and forth. The Englishman sucks at the can, then moves the tin away from his face to chew the thick fluid. He beams at Kip, who seems irritated that he does not have possession of it. The sapper glances at Hannah and hovers by the bedside, snapping his fingers a couple of times, managing finally to pull the tin away from the dark face.
We have discovered a shared pleasure, the boy and I. For me on my journeys in Egypt, for him in India.
Have you ever had condensed milk sandwiches? The sapper asks. Hannah glances back and forth between the two of them. Kip peers into the can. I'll get another one, he says, and leaves the room. Hannah looks at the man in the bed.
Kip and I are both international bastards, born in one place and choosing to live elsewhere. fighting to get back to or get away from our homelands all our lives, though Kip doesn't recognize that yet. That's why we get on so well together.
In the kitchen, Kip stabs two holes into the new can of condensed milk with his bayonet, which he realizes is now used more and more for only this purpose, and runs back upstairs to the bedroom.
You must have been raised elsewhere, the sapper says. The English don't suck it out that way.
For some years I lived in the desert. I learned everything I knew there. Everything that ever happened to me that was important happened in the desert.
He smiles at Hannah.
One feeds me morphine. One feeds me condensed milk. We may have discovered a balanced diet.
He turns back to Kip.
How long have you been a sapper?
5 years, mostly in London. Then Italy, with the unexploded bomb units.
Who was your teacher?
An Englishman in Woolwich. He was considered eccentric.
The best kind of teacher. That must have been Lord Suffolk. Did you meet Miss Morden?
Yes.
At no point does either of them attempt to make Hannah comfortable in their conversation, but she wants to know about his teacher and how he would describe him.
What was he like, Kip?
He worked in scientific research. He was head of an experimental unit. Miss Morden, his secretary, was always with him, and his chauffeur, Mr. Fred Hartz. Miss Morden would take notes which he dictated as he worked on a bomb, while Mr. Hartz helped with the instruments. He was a brilliant man. They were called the Holy Trinity. They were blown up, all three of them, in 1941, at Erith.
She looks at the sapper, leaning against the wall, one foot up, so the sole of his boot is against a painted bush. No expression of sadness, nothing to interpret. Some men had unwound their last knot of life in her arms. In the town of Anghiari she had lifted live men to discover they were already being consumed by worms. In Ortona she had held cigarettes to the mouth of the boy with no arms. Nothing had stopped her. She had continued her duties while she secretly pulled her personal self back. So many nurses had turned into emotionally disturbed handmaidens of the war in their yellow and crimson uniforms with bone buttons. She watches Kip lean his head back against the wall and knows the neutral look on his face. She can read it.
Part 7. In Situ. Westbury, England, 1940. Kirpal Singh stood where the horse's saddle would have lain across its back. At first he simply stood on the back of the horse, paused and waved to those he could not see but who he knew would be watching. Lord Suffolk watched him through binoculars, saw the young man wave, both arms up and swaying. Then he descended down into the giant white chalk horse of Westbury, into the whiteness of the horse carved into the hill. Now he was a black figure, the background radicalizing the darkness of his skin and his khaki uniform. If the focus on the binoculars was exact, Lord Suffolk would see the thin line of crimson lanyard on Singh's shoulder that signaled his sapper unit. To them it would look like he was striding down a paper map cut out in the shape of an animal. But Singh was conscious only of his boots scuffing the rough white chalk as he moved down the slope. Miss Morden, behind him, was also coming slowly down the hill, a satchel over her shoulder, aiding herself with a rolled umbrella. She stopped 10 feet above the horse, unfurled the umbrella, and sat within its shade. Then she opened up her notebook.
"Can you hear me?" he asked.
"Yes, it's fine."
She rubbed the chalk off her hands onto her skirt and adjusted her glasses. She looked up into the distance, and as Singh had done, waved to those she could not see. Singh liked her. She was, in effect, the first Englishwoman he had really spoken with since he arrived in England. Most of his time had been spent in a barracks at Woolwich. In his 3 months there, he had met only other Indians and English officers. A woman would reply to a question in the Naffy canteen, but conversations with women lasted only 2 or 3 sentences. He was the second son.
The oldest son would go into the army. The next brother would be a doctor. A brother after that would become a businessman. An old tradition in his family. But all that had changed with the war. He joined a Sikh regiment and was shipped to England. After the first months in London, he had volunteered himself into a unit of engineers that had been set up to deal with delayed action and unexploded bombs. The word from on high in 1939 was naive. Unexploded bombs are considered the responsibility of the Home Office, who are agreed that they should be collected by ARP wardens and police and delivered to convenient dumps where members of the armed forces will in due course detonate them. It was not until 1940 that the War Office took over responsibility for bomb disposal and then in turn handed it over to the Royal Engineers. 25 bomb disposal units were set up. They lacked technical equipment and had in their possession only hammers, chisels and road-mending tools. There were no specialists. A bomb is a combination of the following parts. 1. A container or bomb case. 2. A fuse. 3. An initiating charge or gain. 4. A main charge of high explosive. 5. Superstructural fittings, fins, lifting lugs, Kopfrings, etc. 80% of bombs dropped by airplanes over Britain were thin-walled general-purpose bombs. They usually range from £100 to £1,000. A £2,000 bomb was called a Herman or an Esau. A £4,000 bomb was called a Satan.